Welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and the studios of WMOT-FM. One of our most accomplished guests on this program is Dr. Sean Foley, Associate Professor of History. He's been on our show on three prior occasions to provide insightful analysis of the Middle East and the Islamic community in diaspora. Read his 2011 article on Malaysian recording artist Maher Zain at theatlantic.com, and you'll see how remarkably well-connected he is. Last year, he studied for 15 months in Malaysia at International Islamic University in Kuala Lumpur, supported by a Fulbright grant. He also visited Brunei, India, and several other nations. We'll find out what Sean discovered about Islam in Southeast Asia. We'll also ask him to assess the ever-fluid Arab Spring, including the Egyptian election, the Libyan election, and the ongoing struggle to oust Bashar al-Assad in Syria. Dr. Sean Foley will join us after these well-traveled words from MTSUnews.com.
Here are a few of the stories now on MTSUnews.com, the university's news and information website. Pioneer rockabilly artist Wanda Jackson, who was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame as an early influence in 2009, will headline the 10th anniversary edition of the Southern Girls Rock and Roll Camp at MTSU, July 23rd through 28th. Highly decorated U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel Joel Miller will be the new Professor of Military Science and Department Chair beginning August 1st. The 39-year-old Miller's previous assignment was in Hawaii for 3.5 years at U.S. Army Pacific Command. And readers of the popular MTSU magazine may now download a free electronic version for their iPads or iPhones. The MTSU Mag app, now available on iTunes, includes multimedia content built into every issue that isn't available in the print editions. For MTSU News at any time, go to MTSUnews.com.
Sean, thanks for being with us once again, and it's the first time I've seen you since you've been back, so welcome back.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure to have an opportunity to travel overseas, in part because of funding from this university, which I very much appreciate, along with the Fulbright, and good, of course, to see you again. It's been a long time, too long.
Yes, it has. We did talk before you left for Malaysia.
Yes, we did.
And we talked on this program about your goals and what you expected to find, and we talked about Malaysia being a place where Muslims could embrace 21st century modernity and their faith at the same time without fear. And then we also talked about your anticipation of comparing Islam in Malaysia to Islam in the Arab world. So what were your most lasting impressions on those two fronts?
Wow. A whole bunch of ones, and not just among Malaysians themselves, but also among people who came to visit Malaysia. I had the opportunity both to write about and to meet a singer named Maher Zain. Maher Zain is originally from Lebanon, but actually was born and raised in Sweden. Raised in Sweden, came to New York City, worked with the top figures in the music industry. I know this is sort of long.
Yeah.
Came back, decided he didn't want to be a music producer, but wanted instead to become a singer, and became the hottest singer in Southeast Asia, particularly Malaysia. While I was there, sold 100,000 records, well over 100,000 records in a country of 28 million people. Normally, someone sells, say, 20,000 records. Mm-hmm. Why do I tell you this? Because he was an example of someone who was very important as a singer, but also someone who had videos and other things and sought to reconcile, on one hand, modern singing. He sung in the modern types of ways that we would expect from American pop music, but doing it with clearly Islamic-themed music, clear Islamic lyrics. And that's an example of something I would have never expected to see, but ran headlong into. Not only did I get to write about it, but I got to meet him and even be a groupie at one of those shows. It's remarkable that I'm here in Music City teaching in a university closely associated with that industry. I never thought I would be interested in music in that way, but found myself both in music, and he talks about modern issues, about reconciling Islam with modernity all at once.
So he is, his very existence or his success is an example of the extent to which Malaysia accepts diversity.
And not only diversity, but technology. He spent virtually no money at all on advertising in the traditional sense of the word. His advertising was done online, on Facebook.
Wow.
One of the things I didn't expect was that Facebook is extremely popular in Malaysia. And in fact, is one of the highest penetrations, something like 40% of the population is on Facebook.
So there's no problem with internet connectivity.
No, there isn't. Most people are on internet. In particular, people are on smartphones. That's the way that people generally do initially connect to the internet. And so that was something that was remarkable. And it's one thing to understand, to think about linking modernity and Islam. It's something very different to see in practice. And it's not just Islam and modernity. Christians and other peoples do it as well. If you go to a church or if you go to a mosque, for instance, in Southeast Asia, you're likely to see a PowerPoint presentation. I specifically remember going to a Catholic congregation where it said, it had a sign up before it, you know, turn off your cell phone and turn in the Lord. So, I mean, that gives you an idea of that context. You see similar things also in a mosque or even in Sikh and in other types of religious communities in Malaysia. There's a degree of an acceptance of modernity, but also an understanding of other cultural traditions.
Isn't it interesting that quite frequently, no matter what part of the world you're talking about, the revolution happens through pop culture instead of through some governmental entity?
Oh, sure. Or at a certain level, pop culture in some ways reflect where we are. Reflect not only necessarily the future, but where we are. And these artists in the beginning of the 20th century, Picasso, other people who were doing things that some people thought strange, were actually, no, they were living in the moment. Mm-hmm. They were expressing something in the moment, in the time period, that others of us who aren't necessarily as involved in the arts can't see as clearly.
How is Malaysia's quasi-Sharia, quasi-secular government working?
Malaysia is a government, first of all, of contrasts. It has 60% of its population is Muslim, but it has a significant non-Muslim population as well, a large Chinese population, which by itself is extremely diverse, and an Indian population, predominantly from South India. And laws are different. Sharia laws, for instance, would, for instance, apply, at least in general terms, to Muslims. But the role of Sharia law or hudud within Islamic law is a debate that is ongoing within Malaysia society and is part of its own definition of how to reconcile its Islamic identity, which is real, but at the same time staying modern and also staying within a tradition that is, they are in Asia. They are part of Asia. They have strong connections and have been able to build a prosperous society because of those linkages, not only to Asia, but also to the Western world as well. In Malaysia, English is sort of a combination of English and Bahasa Malaysian or Bahasa Melayu, the language of the Malay population, often is how language gets done. And that's that type of linkage gives you an idea of that tension within Malaysia. But Malaysians do it very well.
We've talked to you so much about the Arab world in the past. Was this kind of a refreshing change of pace for you to be
sure.
outside of the Arab world?
Sure. It was almost a second graduate student experience would be almost the best way of describing it. It was many of my own previous studies, since I've studied things with Sufism, linkages between Southeast Asia and the Middle East, beforehand. So there was a natural gravitation towards Malaysia. It wasn't by accident that I got there. One of my earliest definitive memories in my previous Fulbright, when I was in Damascus, if I can tell you this story.
Go ahead.
Yeah. I wanted to go visit an important Sheikh Nazm al-Kubrisi. And when I got there, we actually began to have a conversation in Arabic. And then he actually asked me to switch to speaking in English because it was the only language everyone in the room, and there may be a few hundred people with us, could understand. Now, at first, I realized there were some Americans or Western converts to Islam. That made sense. There were some Turks. Okay, but then there were a whole bunch of Southeast Asians. Mm-hmm. They were wearing their sunkuks, the sort of the black hats that they wear, clearly differentiated them from the rest.
Right.
That noted to me, that struck me. The Malaysian consulate actually was close by. The Malaysian flag and the American flag look very much alike. And I went home that night and went to go speak with my neighbor. And the neighbor said to me, where did you go that day? And I explained I had gone up to meet the sheikh. And he said to me, did you meet any Malaysians? I'm like, where did that question come from? And he said, well, actually, there are a lot of Malaysians who come, if they're going on, they're doing their religious duty, obligation, Hajj. They often will go to places like Egypt or Syria on their way or do studying. There are lots of Malaysians, for instance, who live or study in the Middle East and then go back home. And then he said to me, you know, we really want to be like America or Europe or, you know, really advanced like China or those countries. But when we look at a vision that we can get to,
yes,
a linkage between modernity and Islam, it's Malaysia. And as he said that, a commercial came on television. I'll never forget that. It's Malaysia, truly Asia. Mm. And these ads are all over the Middle East. At that time, they still are. Malaysia.
I've seen them on CNN International.
That's right. They're on all the time. They're also on other things. And they've formed an image. And that was my initial image. And so that we're talking 2002, 2003. It's almost 10 years ago. I'm a grad student. And so that image stuck with me, and I knew I had to get there. The former prime minister, Mahathir bin Mohamad, who's still an important political force within Malaysian affairs, also came to Syria when I was there. And I did not have a chance to meet him, but I knew people who had translated for him. And the impact he had on them personally as an individual made me always curious to go.
We'll be right back with more with Dr. Sean Foley right after this. This is MTSU on the Record.
The MTSU Educational Talent Search, or METS, reaches out to students in grades 6 through 12 in Coffee, Grundy, and Warren counties. We provide youngsters who have college potential with educational and financial aid counseling and guide them as they determine their educational and career goals. More than 95% of Educational Talent Search students graduate from high school, and more than 79% enroll in post-secondary education. This is METS Coordinator Debbie Frisbee.
For all the latest MTSU information, go to mtsunews.com.
We're talking with Dr. Sean Foley about his research abroad in Malaysia with a Fulbright grant. It was your third Fulbright, right?
That's correct.
And the other two you worked in where?
I was both in Syria and in Turkey.
You made some side trips while you were in Malaysia. Tell us about the other countries that you went to.
I was very lucky to have opportunities to visit India, again, in part thankfully to the generous scholarship support provided by this university, to go to India, where I got to not only give talks to major universities in New Delhi, but also in Aligarh, which is India's top foremost school of Islamic studies, and form very close linkages with scholars of Islam in India, as well as what are the travels I did? That was the initial. I also did travels to Singapore. I gave multiple talks to the National University at Singapore. I also did talks in Thailand as well. I also gave speeches in Indonesia, as well as in China, as well as in New Zealand.
You were also on Al Jazeera, weren't you not, talking about the Egyptian election?
Yes, I did. Multiple things, actually. And in fact, you realize the world is composed of networks, people knowing each other. Mm-hmm. And you asked about Al Jazeera, and I'm happy you linked it to my speeches, because I gave a speech in Singapore, gave a series of speeches, one of which was to the Middle Eastern Studies Center at the National University of Singapore. And you can, it's actually up online. There's a YouTube video of me doing it. And what I didn't realize was that an announcement sent out about that event in Singapore reached Al Jazeera offices in Kuala Lumpur, and the scheduler wrote me back that day and said, "Would you like to be on Jazeera?" And I said, "Yes, yes, I would." And that was a lot of fun. I'd done some television here and had an opportunity to participate publicly in the multiple things here, and that was fun. But to do it on Al Jazeera was something very different, particularly in the middle of the Arab Spring. Where Al Jazeera wasn't just a reporter, it was very much an active participant. For me also, Al Jazeera wasn't just an opportunity to speak. That was great, and it was wonderful because of the time differences. My parents, who live in California, could actually see me at 9 o'clock at night, their time, while I was on in the middle of the day. That was great. But also, I'd written about Al Jazeera. I'd talked to people who worked with it, but it's something very different to see how their operation works, that when I see the area code from Qatar, I know that that's someone calling me to be on the air that day.
Some people might not know that there is an Al Jazeera English language channel. There's one in Arabic, and there's one.
That's
in
right. There are two parallel networks, and one of them. And I'm glad you brought that up, because the two parallel networks had lived in different worlds in many ways. One website wouldn't necessarily, the English website wouldn't necessarily cover the Arabic, and vice versa. But what was really interesting about what happened during the Arab Springs, the two began to work together in tandem, and it was remarkable to think that here I was, a scholar from Tennessee, who does the Middle East, but in Southeast Asia, on air.
With Malaysia's ability to accept a blend of Islam and 21st century modernity, does it strike you as a paradigm that could be transplanted elsewhere, or are these things unique to its own culture?
The answer is yes, certainly, that there are many things. The Malaysian government likes to talk about something called wasatiyah, or moderation in things. And there's certainly, I think, those types of things can be translated. It was remarkable in Libya, for instance, when the Tripoli fell, that one of the leaders of the transition made a specific mention of that word, wasatiyah. And I certainly think there are many things the Islamic world can learn from the Malaysian experience, but things are different. Remember, there's a different historical experience. Societies that are 90% Muslim in the Middle East are going to have a very different relation to their faith and to their history than societies that are, say, 60% Muslim.
We'll be back with more on MTSU on the Record right after this.
The Concrete Industry Management Program at MTSU fills the need for trained personnel who know concrete technology and techniques. Our alumni go into the marketplace grounded in basic math and science and able to promote products or services related to the industry. Our participation in the Academic Common Market ensures talented students in other states a chance to enroll on an in-state tuition basis. This is Dr. Heather Brown, Director of the program.
To find out more information on this or other university programs, visit mtsunews.com.
Sean Foley is our guest, Associate Professor of History, back from a Fulbright-sponsored excursion in Malaysia and elsewhere, other countries within that hemisphere. But now we're going to turn to the Middle East and the Arab Spring, because it's still a fluid situation. I'm sure you've been keeping up with it.
Oh, sure. The Arab Spring is certainly ongoing. It is an evolving evolution. It is different in different countries. And again, not only in Egypt, but in Tunisia. Tunisia has elected an Islamic democratic government, the Ennahda. Libya just had elections itself quite recently, where it looks like the liberals have done very well. And that should be different again. In different places in Egypt, Islamists have done well, but other people have done well. And it's interesting to see that evolution.
Egypt's new president-elect, Mohamed Morsi, is a member of the Muslim Brotherhood.
And educated in the United States in Los Angeles.
Yes.
Both his children, I believe, are American citizens.
And he's touted as a moderate, which raises a lot of questions, like how much freedom will women have in the post-Mubarak Egypt? And for another thing, why is Morsi making his first official trip outside the country to Saudi Arabia?
First of all, I would say Morsi certainly is, and it's part of an organization, the Muslim Brotherhood, that has undergone a remarkable transformation. When I was in Southeast Asia, a member of the Brotherhood came and talked about their vision for the world. And he was talking about not only is it issues with women, but also with Christians. Getting rid of Mubarak was just the top of the system. The remainder part of the system hasn't changed much. When you had a revolution in places like Iran or in Russia at the beginning of the 20th century, you had mass migrations of people. People leave. You don't have that in Egypt. Instead, the system, and what I mean by system, police forces, everyone from sort of the bureaucrat, the lowest bureaucrat up to the highest general, everyone just below Mubarak, is still in place.
Right.
Now, we have a new president. There is an elected parliament. Whether the status of that elected parliament is something different, but what we're now moving towards is seeing whether this opening of a revolution is a revolution that stalled, or whether we're moving towards something different. In Egypt right now, the people who have run the country since Mubarak was overthrown was effectively the military. And in fact, the military has been running Egypt in one way or form since the 1950s. And again, all the presidents of Egypt up until the current president were former members of the military.
Right.
And so that structure is, that's what I mean, that in what we're now seeing is whether that structure, now that pushed a little bit, but whether that structure now can be pushed even further. And Morsi himself is beginning to do that. He did some initial things, for instance, taking down the presidential pictures from official offices. That's a major thing. But also now he's challenging whether they can bring the parliament back into power.
Right.
Or back into session. And now we're seeing negotiations back or forth, both sides. Again, the military may have the guns and the arms and the ability to put troops on the streets, but Morsi was a democratically elected president.
The question is, how much power does Morsi actually have? How much can he actually wield?
Right, but he has power by definition by being a democratically elected leader.
Right.
And how that social power translates.
Mm-hmm.
Again, the army has to still live within Egypt. The army is still a very popular institution within Egyptian society, but it doesn't necessarily want to have a clash. And there are secular interests as well that are worried about how much Morsi will Islamize Egyptian society.
Mm-hmm.
Why is he going to Saudi Arabia? Money. They need to do major investments, and part of their plan for doing investments is to draw in significant resources from Muslim states, including Malaysia. And Egypt and Saudi Arabia.
But this is not necessarily an indication that Morsi wants to turn Egypt as theocratic as Saudi Arabia is.
No. In fact, the Gulf states, not only Saudi Arabia, but its neighbors have indicated a strong unease with Morsi as a political figure. I was in Southeast Asia. I'm at a conference in Kuala Lumpur beginning of June. Late May and beginning of June, and a diplomat from one of the small Gulf Emirates asked a former prime minister in Malaysia, you know, look, we used to be known for exporting oil. We're now exporting extremism. And he meant the Muslim Brotherhood. Mm-hmm. Will you fight with us against them? We are very uncomfortable about their emergence. So actually quite the opposite. It's probably Morsi trying to calm nerves in Riyadh, not saying that I want to be to create a Saudi-like society. And that's a different question, but to create a more Saudi-like society in Egypt. No, not at all.
Turning to Libya, they had their first national election, as you mentioned, following the death of Gaddafi. There was violence at some of the polling places. Several of them had to close because it wasn't safe to vote, but vote they did. Is there any unifying factor like the Muslim Brotherhood in Libya, or are there disputes between tribal factions still going to be the order of the day?
The first thing to say about is the Libya revolution was a very unique revolution in that it had a significant base of people abroad. I like the joke that the Libyan revolution was planned in Washington and in London, but it wasn't planned in the White House in Whitehall. One of the things that was amazing is online. I'm on Facebook, and one of my colleagues who I went to graduate school was part of a very prominent Libyan family. And so I got to see how she interacted with her friends and her family and also with the Western media online on Facebook. And so there was a whole – the Libyan opposition had a whole structure in place abroad. People had spent years thinking about what type of websites are we going to need, what type of structures are we going to be. Remember, in the United States, there was a significant amount of resistance to being involved in Libya. Now, granted, the issues of mass migrations of people into Europe played a role, but the Libyan opposition was extremely crafty. In building its base, and the same types of people who led that opposition are the types of people who are now leading this new state. And that meant that there are organized political parties, and they're going to probably be in good shape. I've been on air and said I'm optimistic about Libya, and so far nothing has led me otherwise. They seem to be in good shape, and they have one huge benefit, or two, a small population and a lot of oil.
And no Gaddafi.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's by itself. Yeah. I mean, but having that small population, a lot of oil, means that you have the resources in place on your own. They're not going to have to go get the type of money that the Egyptians, for instance, are going to have to get. Remember, the first thing Morsi knows is he's got to get jobs.
Right.
I mean, he's got to look like he's in charge, but the president of Egypt has to show he's got to get jobs, money. Libyans can operate on their own, and that's going to make a significant difference in their ability to build a state. And I can say one other thing. They, you know, as much as we were involved, and we were involved, this was a Libyan revolution. They went and got it on their own. We like to think of freedom as not just something that's given, it's taken. You know, it's something you grab yourself for yourself. And the Libyans, that experience of fighting that revolution, of having that experience, is a very powerful one for them. And yes, there are discussions of minor violence, but from what I understand from my own sources and people who have seen there, that's been overblown. And in fact, everything in Libya looks like they're going to be okay.
And then there's Syria. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has been beating the drum for Bashar al-Assad's ouster in Syria consistently. She wants his butt gone yesterday. And it's easy to understand why. Syria and Iran are allies. At first, Kofi Annan, who's the former UN Secretary General, now acting as a special envoy, said that he and Bashar had no deal to stop the violence. Now he says Assad has agreed to an approach to peace. I don't know what the hell that means.
Kofi Annan has done a lot of work. But the basic problem is you have two sides within Syria both sides that believe that if the other side wins, that's it. That's an end story, and the Syrian, what has been going on in Syria has been horrifically violent, and has the capability of causing all kinds of other issues. There are 500,000 Palestinians who live within Syria, so that's a significant issue. They could draw in potentially. Last spring there were, you know, Palestinians who went to the border that might draw in within Israel, as well as Turkey, as well as having significant blowback to issues within Iraq.
Yes.
So not even talking about what's going on within the country itself, within the sides, and both sides have reasons to look at the way that they look, the way they look at the world, that the way they do, it's going to have a horrible regional impact. And we're not even close to done yet. Although, I mean, the regime is certainly showing significant stress. I'm not there on the ground, so I can't say, but for everything suggests that it's under significant amount of stress. and that will continue for a long time. And it doesn't look like the international community is in a position right now to make a decision about intervention. I don't think anyone really wants to intervene yet. Has to do this, and the Syrians look like they're going to fight it out themselves.
So you would sort of disagree with Secretary Clinton in so far as her thinking that Assad's days are numbered, because she has said Assad's days are numbered. He's the sands are running out of the hourglass.
It certainly seems as if, as I said, the Syrian regime is under significant amount of stress. Mm-hmm. There's absolutely no question about that. It's hard to predict when someone's days will be out, but a regime, look, they're fighting a war. They themselves admit it. We are at war. And if you're at war, you're in a very serious situation. How long that's last, that's a different story. What matters to me less is necessarily the players, but the violence that's been inflicted on a human population and a city that I know well.
We'll be back with more on MTSU on the Record right after this.
The Middle Tennessee State University Women's Studies Research Series features compelling monthly talks on gender-related topics by faculty and graduate students. The series offers a chance to learn about research in progress and to chat with faculty in an informal setting. All lectures are free and open to the public and are held on the MTSU campus. This is Associate Professor of Journalism, Dr. Jane Marcellus.
For all the latest MTSU information, go to mtsunews.com.
And we're in our final moments with Dr. Sean Foley, Associate Professor of History. Tell us what classes you teach.
I teach world history courses and courses in Islamic and, well, prudentially, would say Middle Eastern and world history would be the best way of describing what I teach.
Undergraduate and graduate courses?
Undergraduate primarily, but I also teach graduate courses as well, yes.
So lest you think that these are just personal larks for professional development, be advised that MTSU benefits greatly from what our scholars who go overseas are able to learn and to bring back with them to the students.
And the linkages we form that allow students to go overseas. I've already had students ask about going to India. So I said, okay, this is who you contact. We had a student who's going off to Southeast Asia as a Fulbright this year. The State Department contacted me and asked me to talk to her before she went off on that Fulbright. Those types of things are the connections, not only as a scholar, but also in the classroom, both directly with students and what I present to students, but also on one-on-one working with them to develop their own careers as individuals and as scholars and as, you know, professionals as well.
What are your future travel plans, or are you going to stay here for a while?
Well, I'm going to be traveling to the United Kingdom to give conference papers talks at both Cambridge as well as Exeter. I hope to be back in Malaysia briefly in the fall. I've been asked to chair a panel in September, so I'll briefly do that. And we'll see. I may be working on doing another travel, a longer trip to the Middle East, to the Gulf States, but I'm still in the process of working that one out.
As far as we know, you'll be here for the start of the fall semester 2012.
Oh, I'm certainly teaching here in the fall, the start of semester. Yes, I don't plan on going anywhere that quickly.
Good. Welcome back, Dr.
Thanks
Sean Foley. Appreciate you being with us on MTSU on the Record.
MTSU on the Record, a news and information program about Middle Tennessee State University, is produced by the university's Marketing and Communications Office, which is solely responsible for its content. Read more about MTSU at our website, mtsunews.com. Podcasts of this program are available at mtsunews.com and on iTunes.